Well, before I tell you all about the Tsaris of last year, let me wish you a happy and healthy new year. As I tried to sum up in my own mind 1981, I found that a Hebrew word captured my feelings as well as any other. The word is Irbuvia. It is exactly as it sounds. It defines a confusion of purpose, a milling around, a lack of order, a lack of direction. When troops march out in serried ranks in perfect parade drill, they're acting the very opposite of Irbuvia. Irbuvia is a throng milling around purposelessly, without direction, without any sense that motion forward is taking place. And that's the sense I had during 1981. I thought of Irbuvia as I watched the tens of thousands of European men and women, young men and women, march through the capitals and major cities of Western Europe, protesting the deployment of the cruise medium-range nuclear war-headed missile, protesting nuclear armaments generally, protesting nuclear power, angry, anxious, frustrated, intent on creating the same kind of peaceful world we all pray for. Yet there was a sense of disarray, as though they couldn't quite, and knew that they couldn't quite, achieve their purposes. 1981 opened with a new administration, a very different administration, taking power in Washington. And for Europeans, that administration was something of a frightening specter because it spoke openly and clearly of what it called the Soviet threat, because it sent around almost immediately Secretaries Haig and Weinberger to the various capitals of Europe demanding that our allies in NATO increase significantly their defense budgets and accept the deployment on their soil of this new medium-range missile. The European countries did not want to accept the missile. It felt that they made it a more ready target than they might otherwise have been. They've always been comforted by the idea that the intercontinental ballistic missiles would somehow fly over their heads and that they would be, to a sense, spared by the Armageddon of an atomic war. They didn't want to spend the money that would be involved in an increased defense budget. And so most of these parades and the oratory which accompanied them was directed at Washington, at a president who was accused of being a militarist, of being the spokesman of the military-industrial complex in America, eager simply to sell American arms and to act like the policeman of the world to renew the Cold War. What Washington was saying was that if the free world wanted to maintain its freedoms, it would have to bestir itself to do so. Now, during 1981, Walter LeCur, who's one of the fine strategic analysts of England and the United States, presently the chairman of the Institute for Strategic International Studies at Georgetown University, coined a term for this European attitude. He called it Hollanditis. The very name suggests a disease and suggests the fact that he misprized this feeling. Hollanditis, according to LeCur, consists of the position that we will not have nuclear missiles on our own soil. We will not increase our defense budgets. We will continue to assume that détente is in place, despite Cambodia and the Yellow Rain, despite Afghanistan and the claims of poison gas, despite the duplication of Soviet military power in the last decade, we will continue to assume that there is détente, what is called the Ostpolitik in Europe, that is, the rapprochement between East and West will continue, and that the trade between East and West is a very important element in building bridges of arrangement, mediation, and understanding. He chose Holland as the subject for this policy of appeasement or neutralism, depending on your judgment of it, because in May of 1981, Holland had a parliamentary election in which almost all of the parties took these positions, and in which many politicians of significance began to speak of Holland becoming a pilot country, the first country in Western Europe to accept, to practice unilateral nuclear disarmament. The argument was often advanced that Holland is a small country. What difference would it make to the balance of power between East and West if Holland disarmed itself? But it is symptomatic in Lecoeur's mind of a mood which is spread across Europe. He calls it an ostrich mood, a mood which does not want to look at the realities of international affairs, which for people who for 30 and 40 years since the Second World War have been able to go about their business and build up their interests and live their own lives, who now want only to look after their interests and continue building up their own lives. There was a slogan some years ago, "Stop the world, I want to get off." And that slogan, he feels, is very much in the foreground of European consciousness. And of course, he bases this attitude on a number of factors. The first, the obvious manifest failure of the diplomats of the world to make significant political arrangements which would reduce the danger of atomic war, reduce the necessity of major rearmaments. Secondly, the high cost of modern technological arms, and the fact that during the last 10 years or so, particularly in the last 5 years, the European miracle has diminished. Inflation, recession, unemployment have disturbed Europe quite as much as they have our own country. If more money is to be put into defense, there will be less money to be put into the social issues which Europeans have come to expect as their due. The United States' own role in the world. It's hard to present yourself as the peacekeeper of the world when you are the world's largest armaments merchant. And finally, and perhaps most significant of all, this basic fear of atomic and nuclear power, a fear which we all share. The world has enough nuclear warheads to destroy all population many times over. What logic is there in building more bombs and more sophisticated ways to deliver those bombs and to spend the wealth of the world, to waste the wealth of the world in instruments of destruction which cannot ultimately save the world if they are ever used? Now, when one analyzes Lecoeur's explanation of this mood, this ostrich mood in Europe, One finds within it fear, understandable fear, anxiety, understandable anxiety, the desire to hope against hope that arrangements can be made, and frustration, deep, angry, bitter frustration at those who are in charge of the affairs of the world, at their inability to break through, to negotiate, to make arrangements. Diplomats have been meeting in Geneva almost constantly in the last two decades on arms limitation agreements of one kind or another, and there have been no significant reduction of arms any place in the world, quite the contrary. We add something like 20% to the firepower of the world every year, and have for the last two decades. The world is concerned and frustrated by the inability of its so-called leaders to make the kind of arrangements which would allow all of us to sleep more easily at night. And whatever side you are on, if you look in the mirror, you'll discover that you are purveying arms, armor, and firepower to the rest of the world, to your half of the world. When we complain about the Soviet rearming Iraq or Iran or the millions of billions of dollars of armaments that they've poured into the Warsaw Pact nations, we've only to look into the mirror in 1981 and see the AWACS sale and the sale of almost $20 billion in armaments to Saudi Arabia, to other Gulf states, to states which were so friendly to us around the world. And when we look at that which fuels the emotions of those who marched in Europe, we must understand that they see armaments, as most of us see armaments, as we now look upon the pyramids of the ancient Egyptians. We laugh, don't we, when we think of how the Egyptians put the wealth of their country into mausoleums, places to bury their kings, when in point of fact, they could have spent that wealth to raise the standard of living of the whole country. What else are we doing? What else is involved in this re-examination of budgets throughout the world where we're taking away from people and putting them into weapons? We've had that drama played out before us in the United States. It's the drama, the urgency which America is trying to impose on as policy on our European allies. Now, the Russians have taken the same position. Leonid Brezhnev, during 1981, had to announce to the Russian people that food and necessities would cost almost double what they had cost before. But Russia is a party tyranny. And Mr. Brezhnev has only to announce, and policies are put in effect. And when he wants, as he has every year for the past 10 years, to escalate his military budget, he has only to announce that this will be so. In the democracies of the world, in the free countries of the world, the issue is somewhat more difficult. No president and no prime minister can simply announce that we are going to change the budget in a major way. There's a parliament, there's a House of Congress. Somebody must deal with it. People are heard, and the frustrations of people come to the fore. And during 1981, we had to recognize that, unlike the 1960s and early 70s, the time of economic expansion for the free world and for the first world, the Soviet world also, had come to an end. We had been busy trying to digest the oil shock, and we had not yet sufficiently digested it. There have been major structural changes in the world's economy. The third world was slowly becoming industrialized, and with its cheap labor supply and its new plant was able to outcompete many of the established industries in the high labor cost areas of the world. There was the increase of population was being could not be absorbed by the countries where inflation was limiting the growth of the national product. And where the increased sophistication of industry was making it less and less easy for countries to absorb the undereducated, the illiterate, and those who were not equipped to deal with the complexities of modern society. So there was less with which to bargain. One could not have guns and butter. That was increasingly clear in 1981. And it's understandable that the peoples of the world would much prefer to have butter than to have guns. And of course, beyond all this, overriding all of this was this fear of nuclear energy, nuclear power, nuclear weapons, all that is nuclear. It's a fear of technology. It's a fear of a great danger. It's the fear of putting this great power in the hands of the few. I must confess that 1981 should have made all of us suspicious of what we should have been suspicious already. We've been told for the last 30 years, have we not, that as long as nuclear power is reserved to the so-called responsible nations of the world, it's safe. It won't be used illogically. Well, it was a responsible nation of the world, one we like to think of as responsible, which dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And this year, when Israel surgically took out a military atomic generator from a manifestly irresponsible country, Iraq, the world recognized, one, that it were the responsible countries, France, Italy, Germany, which had provided the knowledge and the money and the skilled technicians which had built this reactor in the first place. And it was the responsible countries of the world which immediately condemned Israel from taking atomic power away from an irresponsible nation. And it was the West European responsible countries which immediately pledged to Baghdad that they would provide Baghdad again with the wherewithal, the skill, the money, and the techniques with which to rebuild the destroyed plant. I don't know how many of you noticed, as I did, the first article that my eye fell upon on the 1st of January in our newspaper was an article which told of a 15-year-old freshman at Florida Atlantic University, a girl, science whiz, who had designed an effective hydrogen bomb and who had also designed a number of improvements on existing atomic bombs. Now, as I read this story of children playing with hydrogen bombs, I thought to myself, the child is a child. But how easy it is now for any country, any terrorist group to get a hold of these kinds of weapons. She indicated that the knowledge was readily available to her. And how long will it be before, instead of the terrorists and the criminals of the world being armed with Saturday night specials and pistols of one kind or another, I noticed more recently that they've graduated to machine guns and hand grenades and an occasional missile launcher. How soon will it be before they have atomic weapons at their disposal? Arbuvia, confusion, disarray, a lack of order and purpose. Now, however much one sympathizes with and one understands what moved at least the majority of those who marched down the streets of Western Europe this last spring and summer and fall, one must wonder whether they are in fact moving towards an attainable goal. What is achieved if they manage to prevent the United States from placing cruise missiles on their soil? Or if they manage to move towards unilateral nuclear disarmament? Will the world be safer? Will they be safe and free? One would like to think that their good intentions would be rewarded. But then in December of 1981, two events happened in rapid succession, which suggested that the administration in Washington was not the malignant, warmongering imperialist administration it was simply portrayed to be, that in fact there was a Soviet threat, and that in fact it wasn't so easy any longer to say simply and falsely better red than dead. Early in December, you recall, a Soviet submarine ran aground on the rocky shoals of one of the islands off the southern Swedish coast. At first, the captain explained that his compass had somehow malfunctioned, and one had the image of a red-faced vessel skipper, you know, standing court-martial for stupidity. But then the Swedish government announced that before this submarine had run aground, it had managed to traverse a very delicate, difficult channel of many miles and had intruded into the waters of a Swedish naval base. And then it was announced about 3 days later that Swedish scientists investigating the vessel had detected that it was carrying torpedoes with nuclear warheads. And suddenly, the level of anti-American parading for nuclear disarmament in Sweden went down a few decibels. Here was an old World War II vintage submarine, Not one of the new submarines of Russia's expanding submarine fleet, but an old one, equipped with nuclear warheads on its torpedoes. A submarine which was quite prepared to go into neutralist Sweden, into one of its naval bases, to intrude in the most dangerous of ways, to risk both a nuclear accident and a nuclear confrontation. And then 3 weeks later, that movement which we had all watched through all of 1981 with fascination and a good degree of hope, solidarity, was suddenly stamped down. Military law was imposed upon Poland. A year and a half ago, you'll recall that the name Lech Walesa became a household name in the West. This union organizer from Gdansk had galvanized a desire among millions and millions of Polish workers to have better wages, more rights, to be free of the heavy-handed tyranny of privilege of the Communist Party. And to a certain degree, we chortled at the fact that here was the ultimate disproof of communist ideology, that the interests of the party and the interests of the worker are absolutely identical. And we hoped, prayed, that Walesa would be able to establish and gain not only the economic rights that he wanted for the workers and an independent labor union, but a degree of freedom for everyone in Poland. And for a few months, there was some degree of freedom. Magazines were published. Comedians in the bistros began making comments about the government. Newspapers began criticizing this and that element of communist policy. And then suddenly, late December, it was all crushed. A military general took over the government and by force of power arrested the leaders of Solidarity, forced the miners to go back to work, forced the shipyard workers in Gdansk back to work, and Poland is now where it was a year and a half ago. Hope, well, hope springs eternal in the human breast, but clearly there's a limit to the freedom, to the opportunity which will be allowed to workers or any other in any Soviet or any Eastern European society. The more to the point, the West had to a classic example of the truth that it wanted to deny, that party tyranny, as practiced in Eastern Europe and by the Soviet, is a vicious, cruel thing, and that exchanging a free government for a government which owes its allegiance to and whose values are determined by the Soviet system is not an exchange that any in the West would willingly, I am sure, want to undergo and undertake. Irbuvia. You find yourself milling around. You don't want the Cold War. You want detente. But really, no one allows you detente. You want peace. You want disarmament. But there's no way really to achieve peace, to achieve disarmament. Confusion, disarray, uncertainty. Northern Ireland, Lebanon, Chad, Ghana, Cambodia, Afghanistan, El Salvador, Irbuvia, disarray and confusion. El Salvador is perhaps a classic case in point and an important one for the American people. Latin America is on our doorstep. It's part of our, really, of our national interest. And I think all of us in America, raised by the traditions which we share or claim we share, are concerned with human rights, recognize that over the centuries, the Indians and the peasants of countries like El Salvador have been abused by the feudal oligarchs who have mostly ruled those countries. They've been used poorly, they've been paid poorly, they've had few rights. There's been almost a feudal way of dispensing justice. We would like to see the broader freedoms, and some of these freedoms are slowly coming into being because the complexity of commercial life as it comes into that part of the world opposes them. But at the same time, if we destabilize the jargon word, if we destabilize the governments of these countries to a degree by espousing all those who are to the left, all those who stand for land reform, who stand for the rights of unions and all the things we take for granted, we may find ourselves, as we have in Nicaragua next door to El Salvador, as we certainly have found in Cuba, we may find ourselves cheek by jowl with a government which is a tyranny of the left, which not only denies to people their freedoms and their rights, but because of ideology lacks the wherewithal to manage intelligently the economy. And so the people are poorer and certainly no freer than they were before. And though there is plenty of example in our world today of right-wing governments unseated by popular revolt, right-wing tyrannies brought to an end, there are as yet few examples of left-wing tyrannies ended. And these tyrannies of the left can be fully as cruel and as vicious as those of the right. When you destabilize the Shah, you often get a Khomeini. When you destabilize a General Salazar, you often get a Sandinista. And so it is uncertain, unclear to most how we are to proceed in this complex and confusing world. Ir Buvia. It's a strange world. In the United States, we elected a president who promised action and gave us action. And his action was essentially to increase the defense budget and decrease the human budget. And he did so by passing on most of the problems of support for human services to the states. He did so quickly. Congress went along with him, and it's not at all clear that the 50 states are willing, able, and prepared to accept the burden that has been passed on to them or have the wherewithal in order to meet it. However much this administration talked about a safety net below which they will not allow people in poverty to fall, services which will not be taken away, no one, because of disarray that was in Congress when the present budget and appropriation bills were passed, no one really knows what the long-term consequences of congressional action were done. I'll never forget Tip O'Neill's comment when finally the budget and the appropriation bills were passed, when he said, in effect, literally, no one in Congress, no one really understood what was being done. It was all done so fast. It was all done under such a sense of urgency and pressure. No one really understands who will be hurt, and how much they will be hurt, how much the needy have been hurt for the benefit of the greedy, to use one of the senator's phrases. A tax cut was put through, which will benefit industry and benefit those who have money with which to invest, which will not benefit those who do not have money to invest, the majority of Americans. And it was put through on the basis of a theory hastily put together called supply-side economics and a computer which was several times reprogrammed in order to give out the figures which would prove that this theory, in fact, had a chance of success. And when the director of the Office of Management and Budget, a young man named Dean Stockman, made his original predictions, he found the computer didn't tell him what he wanted it to tell him, so it's very easy. You teach the computer to lie. You simply feed it other instructions. And even then, he came out with instructions which showed, with figures which showed that under the best of all conditions, we would have a $35 billion deficit this year with the present tax cuts. And now, just a few months later, we find that the deficit is predicted at about $155 billion. Ir Buvia, disarray, confusion of purpose. Lack of direction. Now, how does one live? How does one survive? That's the real question. In a world which is in disarray. Well, I can tell you what you don't do. You don't throw up your hands and surrender. You don't go off to garden. You don't play the ostrich. You don't do what many in Europe used to do and say simply, I'm not political. I'll heal, I'll law, I'll teach, I'll rabbi, but I'm not political. I'll not get involved in the political process. That's what you don't do. You don't surrender your mind or your energies. When mice in an experiment are fed too many confusing instructions, when they're in a state of disarray, they run around in circles, and ultimately they begin to beat their heads against the wall. You don't do that. You don't do what so many are beginning to do in our country and elsewhere in the world, to find a man on a white horse or a simple panacea which is guaranteed to solve all the world's problems. If only we reintroduce prayer into the public schools, if only we censor violence on television, if only we elect all 100% true-blooded Reaganite Republicans to Congress, if only we do this or that or the other thing, all of our problems will be resolved. And that, of course, is nonsense. In a complex world, there are no simple solutions. As I've suggested time and time again to most of life, there are no complete and final solutions. You keep your head. You try and deal with the problems one by one, realistically, as they come down the pike. If I were to put this into religious terms, I would say you avoid messianic thinking. It's messianic thinking to believe that somehow if I lay down my arms, that solves the problems of the world. That if I take away the arms from the policeman, the criminal will put down his weapons. If I don't fight back, nobody's going to fight me, and nobody's going to take from me what I enjoy. Unfortunately, in the real world, there are governments that are criminal governments, that is, they will take anything that is available for the taking, if the risk isn't too great. And there are short-sighted governments, and all governments are run by people with strong personal ambitions for glory. Keep your head. You try and find the facts. You try and act as reasonably and as rationally as you can. There's an old rabbinic saying, "B'makom she'ein ish hishtadel liyot ish." It's a sexist saying, but forgive the sexism. In the place where there are no men, strive thou to be a man. In the place where people have become frenzied, keep your cool. In a place where people have given up, keep going. There is a way. Life has a way of seeing that after each dusk, there's a new dawn. The fact that our world is full of complex problems does not mean that these problems are irresolvable. Governments are human institutions, and they're managed by people. They conform to people's needs, people's aspirations. People can change the nature of governmental policy. The fact that there are so many problems affecting our world at this time means simply that we have to do what we can do within the ambit of our control, and others we must hope are doing what they need to do within the ambit of their control. And one of the things you discover out there in the world is that there are billions of earthlings who are seriously trying to grapple with the problems that confront them. That's one of the reasons for hope as we enter a new age. Irbuvia, confusion. Plans without the ability to fulfill them. My favorite cartoon during 1981 showed the president and the first lady besides a Christmas tree unwrapping packages. And there was a great big package all beautifully beribboned. And Mrs. Reagan, who apparently loves things all too much, is delighted by the size of the package, and she says to the president, "Look, here's your gift from the Congress." And they both look delightedly at the package, and he opens it, and he says, "Ah, it's an economic recovery package." And you see them looking deeper and deeper in the box, and finally one turns to the other and says, "You can't tell which one is speaking." She said, "But there are no batteries." Plans without the ability to make them go. Plans which are not really thought through. Promises rather than plans, figments of the imagination rather than practical programs. 1982, a new year, by the very fact of being a new year, a time of promise. 1982, will it be a better year? Why should it be? Why should any year be better than any other year? It'll be exactly what we and the millions like us make it to be. We are not fated. Nuclear war is not inevitable. Recessions are not inevitable. Countries do not have to continue this crazy arms race that we've all gotten ourselves into. There are other ways. Diplomats could sit down and work out arrangements, provided their governments wanted it, provided their peoples force it, if their peoples have the ability to do so. Keep that simple truth of our tradition in mind. Against the Greeks, who believed in fate, who believed that one's destiny was determined, our tradition has always affirmed freedom, the possibility of a better tomorrow, but has also said, you have to make it so. You have to bestir yourself. You have to do all you can do, and when you think you're doing all you can do, you have to do more. And like Moses, you may never get to the promised land, but you've got to be on the way. And if you're on the way, that's the satisfaction which comes in living. You're doing what needs to be done, and that's the measure of hope which God has allowed to all of us and to any of us. No guarantees. God never promised us a rose garden, certainly not in Cleveland. No guarantees. But life, and possibility, and a goodly measure of hope. If only we can begin to pull people together to diminish this sense of disarray, confusion of purpose. So next year, the sense of irbuvia is more limited than it was this year. And there's a sense of people walking together with some kind of commitment to value. Happy New Year.